Hi, my name is Jill Zamorski, and welcome back to Reading and Drinking on the Psalm TV Podcast Network. On today's show, I am talking about a book entitled Tangled Vines, Greed, Murder, Obsession, and an Arsonist in the Vineyards of California, written by Francis Dinkelspiel. So this book has, it covers a lot, but there's a little quote that I want to start off with about wine. She writes, "Most people who drink wine reach for bottles that cost less than $10. But there is a smaller yet influential group that regards wine as more than just a beverage. Those people think of it as an elixir, something that changes feeling and mood. Wine can be a portal into the mystic. Just as grapes are transformed into wine through fermentation, people are transformed by wine. It warms our bodies up as we sip it. It cheers us up. A bottle shared around dinner can enhance friendships. Taken to the extreme, wine can loosen tongues and let out long suppressed truths." All of those things are correct. But you know what? Wine also, there's a dark side to the wine world. And this book uncovers and discusses a whole aspect and history of wine that I didn't know about. You guys know how much I love learning from books that I review in this podcast, and this book is no exception.
This episode is brought to you by Napa Valley Vintners. The most renowned wine growing region in the U.S. is also one of the smallest and most diverse in the world. The valley floor is just 30 miles long and just 5 miles across at its widest point. Find out more at napavalley.wine. And also check out the Napa Valley Sessions, which are hosted by knowledgeable moderators that engage in conversation with local Napa wine producers. That's napavalley.wine.
I've got to admit, I am a little embarrassed that I was not previously familiar with this book. It's not brand new. It was published in 2015, so it's been out. It was a New York Times bestseller. I have, if you're looking for it, I have a paperback copy. It's like 5x7, and on the cover is a picture of two glasses of red wine with like flames coming out of one of the glasses and what would be like singe marks on the edge of the book. The book's not actually burnt, but it is a story about arson. And my career in wine, you know, it's been lengthy for sure, but my first job as a sommelier was in 2006. I'd worked in restaurants and with wine prior to that, but I didn't have that as part of my title. And this book centers around a crime that happened in 2005. And I just don't remember, this is a true story. I just don't remember hearing about it. And that could be that maybe I wasn't as in tune to the world of wine, or maybe I was living on the East Coast and it didn't make it into the news cycle as much. I'm not sure why, but man, am I glad to know about it right now. So what is this book about? Well, it's True Crime Meets Wine Part 2. And I do kind of love, if you've been listening to this podcast for the past couple of years, you hopefully have either listened to the pods or read the books that I've covered earlier. I'm specifically referring to Shadows in the Vineyard and Billionaire's Vinegar. And those two books, not to re-review them on this podcast, but Shadows in the Vineyard details a really nefarious plot to poison the vines and then extort money from the owner of Domaine de la Romanée Conti in Burgundy. And then in Billionaire's Vinegar, it's this whole story about different types of wine fraud and characters, real life characters, not made up characters from that book, Billionaire's Vinegar, make their way into this story. So what this book is about, and I should mention that the author is related distantly to one of the characters in this book. So this book is kind of organized in an interesting manner. There's both a historical component detailing some of the very beginning of grapevine cultivation in California and the kind of nascent wine industry in California, starting with when California was still part of Mexico, and then the influx of Franciscan friars and missionaries and the cultivation of the mission grape and the planting of vines and the, you know, the making of wine and how things kind of evolved. And for a long time, the center of the wine industry in California was actually in Southern California, close to Los Angeles. It wasn't until much later, as is detailed in the book, some of the most famous areas are now in Northern California. But the history aspect of this book is that in the 19th century, in the early 1800s, sort of what's called the rancho era of Southern California, where large tracts of land, which have now been split up and are basically cities unto themselves, would basically belong to one individual. Sometimes they weren't even detailed in specific maps, but we're talking about hundreds and thousands of acres that would be these large ranchos. And there were, you know, individual landowners who owned them. And the rancho in particular is called Rancho Cucamonga. And it was a huge tract of land. And it has passed through several, you know, iterations and generations, and the family that once owned it no longer does. And it's, you know, a fraction of what it was. The original buildings don't exist anymore. But the greed and the murder part details through several different generations, owners of this original tract of land that was planted to vines. There were some men who were murdered as a result of their ownership and their attempted ownership. And three of the five men who died who were affiliated with this vineyard, their murders were never solved. So there is a real true crime murder element. And one of the eventual owners of that tract of land is the great, I believe, great, great, great grandfather of the author. So that ancestor, Isaias Hellman, made wine. And one thing we have to remember, if you are a wine lover, you probably are familiar with the fact that there have been wines produced in California using region or style names of European wines, such as Champagne, Chablis, or Port. And some of the wines that are referenced that were produced in these original tracts of land are referred to as Port, even though, of course, they didn't come from Portugal. They were just a fortified wine made in the style of Port. So it's important to get that clarification out of the way. And anyway, this ancestor did produce Port. There's no even, I should mention, clarification that it wasn't actually Port, that it was just an appropriated name. It's just referred to as Port. So just understand that this is not a reference text or an academic book. But this ancestor produced Port and then a sweet, fizzy white wine called Angelica. And some of those bottles that were, you know, vintage late 1800s had been passed through the family in several different generations and ultimately were stored in a wine storage facility in Northern California near Sausalito. And that's where this story intersects with the modern day arson and greed and obsession trail. So there is a connection through the author. It doesn't so much connect the stories back and forth. And the way the book is organized is very helpful because it does jump back and forth to what is roughly present day in the 2000s and then what was 150 years ago. So the way the book begins, it starts off with the major characters, which seems like an unusual way to start off with a book. But because there are largely unknown to me people in this book, it's actually really helpful. And then as you read through the book and you're not sure who someone was, if they get, you know, because the chapters kind of go back and forth in time, you can reference the character list. These are real people. This is a true story. There is a map of the original Rancho Cucamonga. And then there is this prologue about a fire being set. So the book actually starts with a mystery man in black. I'm not kidding. That's how he's described, setting a fire intentionally in a wine storage facility. And then once that initial scene is described, then there's sort of the backstory. So it's the book is divided up into parts. Each part contains multiple chapters. They are entitled Destruction, Invention, Fabrication, Expansion, Deception, and Redemption. And it's pretty fascinating how it all starts out. And I've got to say, the author, I mean, I've not read any of her other books, but it's kind of a mystery novel. And there is a style of writing, if you enjoy mysteries, where any avid reader would probably recognize this, where you read a paragraph and the last sentence of the paragraph is like, if there was a soundtrack, it would be like, dun, dun, dun. And so in the beginning of the book, when we're talking about this, you know, this intentionally set fire, there's a paragraph on page 24. It says, it's the pursuit of the experience, the belief that wine opens up worlds and forges friendships that drives people to be so obsessed. Of course, I have a tone when I read this to myself because it's, you know, this really insidious crime. Humans have worshipped wine for eons, from Noah to the Greeks. It's also what drove Mark Anderson. So Mark Anderson is, he's the evil villain in this book. And wow, he's an interesting guy. He's, I should say, still in prison, serving a very lengthy sentence. So spoiler alert, he was convicted of the crime of arson. But basically what happened is he's this kind of odd individual, and he's described in very thorough terms in this book. And I should say that the author has met him through the panes of like a visitor cell in a jail. And he wrote copious letters to her and she wrote back to him. So there's information gleaned through interviews and, you know, folks in and around Sausalito where Mark Anderson lived. And yeah, let's just say he's an interesting guy. So he was one of those folks, and there's a lot of parallels between him and Rudy Kerniawan, who is the villain in The Billionaire's Vinegar, or one of the villains in The Billionaire's Vinegar. And what I mean by that, the similarities between the two, they're not physical similarities, but they are folks who are kind of live lavishly and, you know, drink extravagant wine and travel and put on this facade of living a, you know, a really, really fancy life of being a collector and loving to rub elbows with, you know, the who's who in the wine world. But they're covering up, obviously, something that is the complete opposite. So Mark Anderson, it details his early life and his kind of fallout with his family. His brother thought that he was shady for a long time, to the point that his brother, Stephen, actually developed a website and talked about what a shady guy his brother was. They ceased contact early on in this story. But Mark Anderson was just this like guy around town in Sausalito. He was involved in all kinds of civic boards. He was a frequent diner at a really classy sushi restaurant. He used to travel. and he fancied himself to be a big collector. And the story details, again, back and forth between the history of the wine origins and wine production in California with this modern day presence. But essentially what happens is, in addition to just, you know, kind of talking about wine and bragging about wine and drinking wine, he decided that he would start a, it was initially called Sausalito Cellars, and it was a wine storage facility. People get really obsessed about wine, and this book points out a big flashing red light that has definitely tripped up lots of people and lots of organizations who get really into the collecting community. And so he, through his, you know, connections with business people and fancy wine drinkers and collectors, offered up his services as this wine storage, you know, business. He created a website, and this is in the early 2000s. And so it's like in the beginning of the internet age. He promised, you know, all of these high tech security measures, none of which actually were in place, but nobody ever investigated. So all of these people started sending their wine, food and wine societies and individual collectors, and sending him cases of wine to store. And there's a huge problem with that. And caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. A lot of these collectors believe in the idea of cellaring wine. So you're storing your wine with the idea that over time it will evolve and hopefully improve in the bottle. And so if you are storing your wine in offsite or long-term storage, it's supposed to be dark and temperature controlled and humidity controlled, optimal conditions for the wine to age, which means you probably don't need to check up on it all the time. But that also means that there's a huge amount of trust that you're placing into the person or the entity who is storing the wine. I have myself stored wine in offsite storage, and shout out to Dominion Wine Storage in Chicago. They do a really great job. It's, you know, key fob password protected to enter, and you know, the individual storage spaces are locked and there's security cameras everywhere and it is temperature controlled and they have backup generators and there's all these security measures, right? But if you're storing your wine for a long time, you might not be checking up on it. And some of the people who were storing wine with Mark Anderson also weren't local. So they definitely weren't checking up on it. And he lived the life of a bon vivant. And he, you know, he was always buying and spending and you know, going out and being Mr. Social and drinking really fancy wine. And so he had to keep up appearances. Now, it turns out that he also drained his elderly father's bank accounts. He would continually ask his father for money. His father indulged him. Eventually, he basically bled his father dry, probably one of the reasons why his brother ceased contact with him. And he found himself in some dire financial straits. And well, you know, that can certainly lead people to make some very poor choices. And so what he did, and it blows my mind that I was not aware of this because it's just so audacious and it's so, oh my God, it was entirely preventable. But he realized he had millions of dollars of other people's wine under his control. So what do you think he did? Dire straits, no money, had all this wine from trusting, you know, clients and fellow collectors. He started to sell their wine. And it's so shady. But here's the crazy thing. The people who he sold the wine to, auction houses and other retailers, they didn't do the due diligence to make sure that he had the right to sell the wine. Maybe they just verbally asked, do you legally have the ability to sell this wine? And he just lied to them. And he said, yes. And so he started to sell other people's wine. And what kind of came out of this is eventually people started to, you know, check up on their wine. And one of the most famous examples is there was actually a restaurant in San Francisco that was closing. And while they were sort of dealing with all of their financial, the fallout of closing the restaurant, they had a pretty substantial wine cellar and they needed to store the wine till they figured out what they needed to do with it. And they stored something like 700 cases of wine with him. So this is big time storage. And years later, after Mark Anderson, our villain, has been selling off wine and pocketing the money, by the way, selling the wine like it's his own and then keeping the money to like fund his lifestyle. For example, the owner of the restaurant came a calling and wanted to pull all of his wine out of storage because they figured out what they were going to do with it. And he had the records of storing 700 and some odd cases of wine. And Mark Anderson replied that he had like 100 cases of wine. And this is where you think this guy must be some kind of psychopath because he just always just lies and obfuscates and gaslights people and says, no, that's just not the facts. And he just makes up stuff. And it's almost infuriating to read this book and see how this guy reacted. That's not the what the whole story is about. That's sort of the background of how this guy is so shady. What the big story and the investigation is about is, again, spoiler alert, Mark Anderson sets a fire. So he moves the wine, which he had been depleting from his clients, from his small Sausalito cellars to a much larger wine storage facility called Wine Central. And it had been like a former building that had housed like former like naval equipment and things like that. So it was basically a bunker. It was built to be earthquake proof. It had concrete walls that were feet thick, and it was basically indestructible. And it wasn't just his client's wine that he moved into there. Lots of wineries stored their wine there. So it's a huge operation. So I have to read this one little quip, and it's in a chapter actually that details lots of poems that Mark Anderson's brother published about him on his website about how Mark Anderson is a fraud. They're really funny. They're like rhyming poems, but his brother clearly hated him. And so there are all these poems pulled from that website, but there's a little kind of just a little paragraph at the end. And it said, it's unclear at what point Anderson realized that he had a huge amount of capital, liquid capital, get the pun, it's liquid, in his possession. And it wasn't money to be collected from rent. Because of course, if you are storing your wine in an offsite storage, you're paying money every month. It's usually not a whole lot of money, depending on the size of the unit that you're storing your wine or the quantity of wine. But it was wine, all those bottles of wine in Sausalito cellars, bottles of fancy Bordeaux and Burgundy, hard to find cult wines, huge magnums of California Cabernet. They all had cash value. If Sausalito cellars wasn't bringing in lots of money, perhaps there was another way to liberate its resources. Dun, dun, dun. So again, there's all these kind of cliffhanger type sentences. And the woman who owned, or not the woman who managed, I should say, Wine Central, she was always, as detailed in this book, a little suspect about Mark Anderson. She never believed he knew as much as he said about wine. He would talk her ear off and spin tangents and drop names and be really braggadocious, but she thought he was shady. And in the very beginning of the book, when it sets the scene for the fire, she was one of the few people working in the wine storage facility and describes how he came in. He was, of course, caught on security cameras with a duffel bag, went to his area where he stored his wines. And what he was carrying was, inside his duffel bag, a bunch of gasoline-soaked rags and a blowtorch. And he basically set the place on fire to cover his tracks. The fact that he had been selling his clients' wines without their permission and pocketing the money. Well, he didn't just destroy the evidence of his own crimes. He destroyed millions and millions of bottles of wine. And that's where the real kind of meat of this story comes in, because of course, this is arson and this is a huge crime. And so they bring in to investigate the crime, not just the local police, but the FBI and the ATF, and investigators who not just specialize in arson, but who specialize in wine-related crimes. And so it's this really fascinating combination of the worlds of, you know, criminal justice and wine, and they all come together. For example, one of the lead investigators had been the lead investigator on the Unabomber cases. If you remember that, where Ted Kaczynski was like sending explosive devices around the country and, you know, explosive devices fire, they kind of fall under the same incendiary category. So this book details not just what Mark Anderson did in setting this fire, his backstory, but also the stories of the producers who lost so much in this fire. This book also talks about other wine crimes. And there's a lot of criming that goes around in the wine world. I guess we don't hear about it. And the author does suppose, and I think that she's onto something, that maybe one of the reasons we don't hear about these crimes is that people who are victims of these crimes are maybe a little bit embarrassed about the fact that they were so naive. And Billionaire's Vinegar touches on that a lot. So if you recall, or if you're familiar with that book, or you listen to the podcast, or you read the book, one of the things it talks about is Hardy Rodenstock and possibly passing off these, you know, fake old bottles, but specifically with Rudy Kerniawan, sort of a modern day character. He was doing some pretty simple stuff. He did have a lot of money. He did buy and sell wines, but he did some stuff that maybe people should have been suspect on. He would go to fancy restaurants like Corton or Crew and drink really fancy wines with really fancy people. And then he would request the sommeliers ship him the empty bottles home from his lunches or his dinners. And they did. They thought he just wanted to collect them. And then he would like fill them back up at home with really inexpensive wine. And when the FBI finally raided his house in California, they discovered everything. Faulty labels, fake labels, recipe books about how to fake old Bordeaux. Like one part, you know, oxidized Bordeaux, one part California red wine, like all this stuff. And, you know, he was imprisoned, recently released. And so there are these crimes. But one of the people who really made it kind of a public thing is this guy named Bill Koch. So he's part of this billionaire brotherhood of his brothers. They use their billions for conservative political activism. But Bill Koch specifically is really into sailing and also a huge wine collector. And so he was duped. He bought some of Rudy Kerniawan's fake wines at auction. And as a really competitive person who also had unlimited deep pockets, was not happy about that and decided to use all of his resources to fight him on it. Many, many, many other people, certainly socialized with Rudy Kerdiawan, bought his wines, drank his wines, and never suspected anything either. But they didn't come forward. And the idea is that maybe they're just embarrassed. And I think that that's probably some of the possibilities, is that, you know, a lot of people were really embarrassed that they took somebody just on their word and didn't do more due diligence and didn't check stuff out. Even after Mark Anderson was under investigation for embezzling and selling wine that was not his, before even the arson investigation, he was under investigation for embezzlement because his clients were discovering their wine was missing. He was still selling off clients' wines. Like, it didn't stop him. His hubris knew absolutely no bounds. But there's all this wine criming that happens and has happened for a long time. And this book details some really fascinating other crimes. So it talks about how there was another offsite storage facility near Irvine called Legend Cellars. And, you know, the owner's father actually managed it. And the owner's father came up with a plot and had different ways of stealing wine. Sometimes he would be stealthy and enter the warehouse wearing gloves, and hired a locksmith to make duplicate keys to all the different lockers. And he would remove expensive bottles of wine and replace them with cheap wine. Or he would open up boxes and, you know, take out the wine and then nail them back up. You know, some wine comes in a fancy original wood boxes. In this instance, the wine storage facility's owner's father stole about $2.7 million of wine. That's insane. Absolutely insane. But you just don't hear about it quite as much. And that's not all the, you know, the criming that gets, the crime that gets detailed, but it's like this action that people are taking. A little bit more recently in 2014, there was something that I definitely remember seeing in the news because on Christmas Day, thieves broke into the French Laundry, which is this, you know, famed three-star Michelin restaurant in Yountville in California, Thomas Keller's restaurant. It was closed for the holiday. And it was also closed because they were about to undergo a six-month renovation. And it was clearly an inside job because thieves broke into the wine cellar and they cherry-picked and stole 76 bottles, including verticals. So same wine from same vineyard, just different vintages, from Domaine de la Romanée Conti and Dom Perignon Champagne, about $300,000 worth of wine. Most of the bottles, by the way, were recovered a few weeks later at the home of somebody in North Carolina, a collector who had either been, I can't remember the details and it's not included in here, if they were part of it or if they just unwittingly bought this wine that somebody tried to sell them to launder and, you know, obscure the money trail. And so sometimes there's the outright theft, but some of my favorite stories that I maybe wasn't as familiar with, I mean, they're really funny. So there's a note in here about a wine theft ring in Sonoma County in 2008. Again, all this stuff that I never knew about. And it was a group of folks led by a customer sales rep working inside a distribution center for Jackson Family Wines, which is a really large company that owns lots of different wineries. It's an umbrella organization for dozens of wineries. And the sales rep, inside job, set up shipments of wine to fake customers. And then that person would report the wine as lost so it couldn't be traced. The sales rep and his co-conspirators would then sell the bottles of red Bordeaux-like wine valued at $150 or $175 a bottle on eBay. And then they sold some to wine retailers. They got caught when they sold some wine that had not yet been released to the public because certain types of wine are aged for a certain amount of time. And so that's how the police, a company official noticed it, and they reported it to the police and they realized it must be an inside job. The list of all the different types of wine crime, it's kind of fascinating because you realize that maybe the world of wine, people often look at it as like super niche and the fancy wine world is, you know, this very elite, very small, maybe annoying, maybe arrogant, and people just don't pay as much attention to it because of it. But a lot of wine out there is very, very valuable. And when people get into these, you know, very obsessed mindsets, these collectors who want the rarest bottle, the biggest bottle, the impossible, the ungettable get, I think it seems to happen because there's so many stories about it that people maybe don't trust their instincts or don't take as much care in, you know, making sure that these wines are legit and are coming from a legit source. They just want to have that thing. And it is a little bit gross, right? I mean, obviously it's illegal, but this kind of obsession and that people get so crazy about obtaining these wines, it is pretty gross. And I don't like that has a, you know, an association with what is ostensibly, you know, this craft industry of artisans and farmers and people who really do appreciate wine. But the stories are hilarious. And sometimes the reason these folks get caught is because they are absolutely stupid. There's a detail of how a couple of men stole 200 cases of wine from a wine store in Seattle. And they made a few mistakes during their burglary that ultimately led to their arrest. you know, they spray painted security camera lenses, but they didn't cover them completely. And so an employee of the wine store was able to identify them. And when the police finally caught up with one of the individuals, wait for it, they found a black gym bag with lists of wine and descriptions in it, along with emails to a San Francisco wine broker offering to sell about 100 grand worth of wine. Inside the glove compartment of the burglar's SUV, police found a notebook that had, quote, the plan, end quote, written on the title page, including a step-by-step to-do list for wine theft, including what tools to buy, how to destroy evidence, and how to escape to another country. By the way, that level of stupidity didn't just land with those burglars in Seattle. When police and ATF raided Mark Anderson's apartment more than once, they found numerous books that he had purchased about how to change your identity, how to disappear off the grid. I mean, you kind of have to be glad that when people are that arrogant and that stupid that they get caught. But one of my favorite stories here is wine fraud on a commercial scale. And it details, you're probably familiar with, maybe you've heard of the box wine Franzia. It takes its name from an individual named Fred Franzia, and his crime is detailed in here, where back in the 1980s, Zinfandel was quite a big thing, and then white Zinfandel became quite a big thing, and the price of Zinfandel grapes skyrocketed, and to the point that there just wasn't enough Zinfandel being produced. And so this book details how several different wineries would go to great lengths to bring in grapes to their large facilities and change the tags that identified the lots and when they were picked and by whom, and pass off other lower quality, lower price grapes as Zinfandel. And eventually, you know, so much of solving a crime seems to be paperwork and records and fact checking. I mean, that makes sense, right? And a lot of what Franzia was selling as Zinfandel, 1 million gallons of it, worth approximately $5 million. By the way, that would be a gallon of wine costing $5. You get what you pay for. So this is not, the world of crime is not always very expensive wine. Sometimes it's very inexpensive wine. But Franzia had passed off, they were misrepresenting tons and tons of Grenache and Colombard grapes as Zinfandel. And they had passed off about 1 million gallons of wine worth about $5 million as white Zinfandel when it was made from other, she says it, varietals throughout this whole book. She says varietals. It is what it is. Franzia, they caught up to him. He had to pay a $500,000 fine, and he was forced to step away from his company's presidency and board for 5 whole years. By the way, he did actually ask President George W. Bush for a presidential pardon, apparently because he wanted to own a gun and he couldn't do that as a convicted felon. By the way, his application for clemency was denied. So there's corporate crime, there's individual crime, and this book details all of it. So it is a timeline of the wine industry in California. It is the story of this crazy arson, but then it also details all these other levels of wine crime. So it's, if you like murder podcasts and crime shows, like, this book is going to be good for you. And it is, there's also, I got to say, like, in addition to the history and all like the dark side of the wine world, there's also a lot of real sad things in here. A lot of people lost a lot of money. And I do recognize that, you know, these wineries and these wines that are so expensive, that maybe not everyone has sympathy, but one of the things this book does a really good job of detailing are the wineries that were affected, that stored their wine. For example, Viator, Delia Viator, her wine, she lost an entire vintage of wine. And the only reason that her wine was at Wine Central is that her winery on Howell Mountain was being, the cellars were being expanded and the construction went longer than it should have. So they didn't have room for the new harvest to come in with what was already in the cellars. So they had to temporarily store finished wine offsite, and she lost a whole vintage. And these are expensive, you know, these are expensive wines, and maybe people don't want to sympathize with someone, but when you think about it, on its very core level, wine is, it is an agricultural product. Many people's lives depend on it. You know, people are tending the vineyards, are harvesting the grapes, they're crushing and fermenting, and their wineries employ all these people. And if you don't have a whole vintage's worth of wine to sell, the repercussions of that are huge, because it can be hard, especially for these expensive wines, to get a placement in a store or on a restaurant wine list. And if that wine sells, then whoever owns that store or runs that wine program, they're going to want to keep reordering it. And if a whole year goes by and they can't order anymore, you might never regain that placement back. And so there's just no income. And so, you know, it wasn't just Viator, it was Saintsbury, it was Longmeadow Ranch, like wineries that you're probably familiar with. And what's really sad in particular is talking about how a lot of these wineries, because again, despite the history of California wine industry, a lot of these are producers that maybe became established in like the 1980s and 90s and 2000s. They're relatively recent. And maybe they were storing, in some cases, it's detailed what's called their library. And what that means is examples of wines from every vintage they've ever produced. And doing that to see how the wines age. And that can be really exciting because if you have 20 years worth of wine and you have the ability to taste every single year, like how cool is that experience? And some wineries lost their entire library. And it's just really sad. It details, you know, winemakers just absolutely crying. You know, Ted Hall from Long Meadow Ranch running into Kathy Corison at like the Napa Farmers Market. And she'd been the consulting winemaker there and everything that she had worked on was gone. And, you know, he's breaking down and crying. And, you know, he spoke at one of Mark Anderson's trials and probably had a big influence on his sentencing because it sounded like maybe he was going to get a, not a slap on the wrist, but, you know, a lesser crime because he was, you know, in his 60s and the judge didn't want him to spend the rest of his life in jail. And yeah, it was a lot of money, but is it a victimless crime? No, there were a lot of victims. And so it details just how profoundly it affected the wine industry. Sterling Vineyards, which is a much larger producer, lost like 40,000 cases of wine. I mean, it's just phenomenal the amount of havoc that this one individual wreaked on the California wine industry and individuals on their own. And the crazy part is, yes, he's still in jail. And he did plead guilty, but he's, I don't know, he's got some kind of personality disorder because he keeps trying to appeal it, keeps trying to say that he didn't actually mean to plead guilty. Like, it's really kind of fascinating. So I could go on and on and tell, you know, all these different stories, but it's a really interesting book. I like the fact that there are producers that I'm familiar with, and I didn't know that that was part of their history. But then there's also so much about the history of, you know, California's wine industry and how it became such a juggernaut and how it never looked back. But how it started is obviously so far from where it's come. So it's a wild ride.
So how do all these stories and all these different plot lines come together? Well, they all come together in the fire. So as I mentioned, the author's like great, great, great grandfather became one of the eventual owners of the Cucamonga Vineyard and produced this port and Angelica wine. And the bottles were passed down through the family. And ultimately, one, I believe it was her aunt, one of her family members had about 170, 175 bottles of this, you know, heirloom wine, essentially, and it was being stored at Wine Central. So that's the big connection. And of course, it was destroyed. There are still some bottles around. They pop up in auction every now and then because that wasn't the only source, but it was a large cache of antique wine that tied the author to kind of knits the whole story together. And there's the real sad part is sort of what happens after Mark Anderson is, you know, convicted is then there's just this massive cleanup. And there's an interesting detail. I've mentioned it before. I mentioned it in Pappyland and in a couple other books about how when you have really valuable wine or spirits that to avoid counterfeiting or other potential issues, you have to destroy empty bottles and things like that. And there is a little interesting inclusion in here in the beginning. And Delia Vieter wanted to make sure that she kept really close control of the bottles of all of her wine that were being stored in Wine Central because, and I don't remember hearing about this, but she remembered there had been a fire. Don't know why it happened, if it was natural or arson, but there had been a fire at the Rombauer Frank Family Winery in Calistoga in 2000. And a bunch of wineries lost collectively about $40 million of wine. But here's the crazy part, and this is why she was so concerned. Instead of destroying the ruined wine, an insurance company sold it to a salvage company, which was supposed to remove the labels off the bottles of burned wine, or the superheated wine, I should say, which will ruin it. The salvage company sold 9,000 of those bottles, labels intact, to an import company who passed the wine off as new. So wine lovers bought the damaged wine, expecting it to taste good, only to find out that it had a burned flavor. Lawsuits followed, and winemakers like Vieter made mental notes to never be cavalier about the disposition of fire-damaged wine. And, you know, what do you do with this massive warehouse that once housed, like, naval ships and warfare and things like that? Well, they eventually, you know, once the case went to trial, brought in a salvage company. And it is kind of interesting to hear about this side of the details. Obviously, because of the hot temperatures inside this building, a lot of, you know, the wine heated up, the bottles expanded, they shattered. A lot of wine just was spilled. Millions and millions of gallons of wine were spilled. But what wasn't was certainly heated beyond a point where it could be consumed. And so they brought in a salvage company. And eventually, after the investigation was complete and it went to trial, they were finally able to clean things up. And they would cart out, you know, pallets and pallets of ruined wine and put it into a big industrial sorter, which would, of course, break the glass. The wine was strained out collectively, thousands of, I think something like 9,000 gallons of wine from these bottles, which was then shipped off to be distilled into ethanol, so industrial alcohol. And then the glass was collected and recycled.
And any, you know, non-scorched cardboard and wood from pallets was then recycled. So in the end, there was just nothing left. You know, they cleaned it all up and I don't know what became of the facility, but it was interesting detail to include. But it again touches on this thing that the potential issue for crime and fraud and counterfeit bottles, it is ever present. And so while super heartbreaking to lose an entire vintage, she also wanted to make sure that, you know, no one else could hurt or harm her reputation, Delia Vietor. And so she had to squelch down all of her, you know, anger and sadness and also just make sure she could do whatever she could to keep her brand intact and her winery going on. It's a wild story. So, you know, when I talk about what works for this book, well, there's a lot to learn. If you're a history buff, if you're a crime buff, if you enjoy wine, or you just like kind of an adventure or a mystery, this is a book that hits all of those nails right on the head. From the get, if you read the jacket or the back cover of the book, it's very clear that there is someone who committed arson and has been arrested for it. That's out there. But understanding what led up to it and who was affected and how that ties in with the history of the forming of the California wine industry is pretty fascinating. It's very, very well written. This author has written other books and I've not read any of them, but I think they sort of touch on her family's connection to the California wine industry. It is not a wine book per se. By that, I mean, there are a few factual things that are inaccurate because the woman who writes this is an author, but she's not a wine professional. So, and I'm not talking about the varietal thing. I'm talking about just terms that we would use to talk about wine where maybe a layperson would misappropriate or use the incorrect term. I don't even think the majority of people who would read this book would even notice this kind of stuff. But talking about like Chateau Cheval Blanc as a Bordeaux varietal, not that it's a Bordeaux varietal, but that's actually a wine. That's the name of a producer. And it's actually a wine made from several different grapes that are blended together. And so it's little things like that I noticed. And I'm like, yeah, this is the kind of stuff that someone who's not a wine professional would miss, of course. But the meat of this book is interesting. It's a wild ride. And so much of it, again, was new to me. I just didn't really know about it. And again, I think this idea that the wine world is like elite and sophisticated and fancy and like good food and good wine. I mean, there's no way to get away from that. Of course, there's so much of that is true. But this is at least the third book in as many seasons of this podcast detailing some sort of wine crime. And there is just some sort of connection that like this stuff drives some people over the edge. And there's probably other aspects about those people that led them to make those choices. But it's this pursuit of wine and I don't know, people get a little crazy. They get a little drunk with power and greed and obsession. And so it's fun. It's a fast read. It's 267 pages. And that does not include sources or a bibliography, which there are plenty of. There's a gazillion footnotes and endnotes in this book. I didn't double check them all, but I think it is really helpful to have like the character list in the beginning. And I should mention that while there is a map, there is a small section in the beginning or in the middle of the book rather that has like, I don't know, maybe it's a dozen pages of photographs. And so it has everything of original photographs of the estate and the people who own the Cucamonga Vineyard in San Bernardino County in Southern California and the various hands, pictures of the people whose hands it passed through. And then also the modern day people who were affected, like Delia Vietor and, you know, Mark Anderson and things like that. And the investigators from the ATF and the lawyers who took him to trial. So it is really helpful. You not only get a little bio of each person, but you do get to put faces with names in this book. It's just a section in the middle. It's not throughout the book, but it does help a little bit just to put a face in your mind's eye. So for my rating, I think this is a buy. You know, it's crazy. I keep coming across really great books, but this is fun. And sometimes the joy of wine books is finding something that appeals to, I think, a broader environment or a broader audience. Because yes, the technical books, the academic books, they might be wine nerds, you know, treasure. And I have a lot of those books and I love reading them and I love reviewing them. But sometimes just a good, like, true nonfiction book about wine that has a really compelling storyline is also really fun to read about. So I'd say, particularly if you enjoyed Billionaire's Vinegar or Shadows in the Vineyard, this is going to be right up your alley because there are similar themes. There are some characters who make their way into all of them, but it's about a whole different scenario. And so it's not going to seem repetitive. It actually might make you think that the wine world is much darker than you realized. So yeah, I think this book is a buy. It's really great. I was so happy to discover it and it was a fun and quick read. So there you go. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed what you heard, and we will be back next week. Please tune in.
This episode was brought to you by Napa Valley Vintners. Visit NapaValley.wine to learn more about Napa Valley, where approximately 475 wineries produce more than 1,000 different wine brands. That's NapaValley.wine.